Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Overmatch Podcast. I'm your host. I'm going to get Kirsten to do more podcasts, man. She's good at it. She's a good personality. So today, back to Irish history, right? We have young Dr. Oisin McIlvany on the phone from Ireland in his doctor's office right there. And nobody's going to walk in behind you in a gown or something, are they? Because I don't want to see that. Gowns are gross. I don't know why you guys use them. So, Oisin, thanks for being here, brother. It's really cool to get you on the phone. I know you're a busy man.
I know, no bother at all. Happy to be here.
You're treating the sick over there. You're a respiratory, that's your specialty, right? So COVID would be one of your things, right? That whole respiratory.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, all the good stuff, you know?
All right, you obviously don't want to talk about doctor shit, so we're going to move on. But I appreciate you being here, man, taking the time. So I just got back on Friday night from, Marine Corps. And my wife's like, can you do a podcast with Oisin on Sunday? I was like, sure. I like talking to Oisin. So here we are, and I have absolutely no idea what we're going to talk about. So maybe I'll shut the hell up and just let you talk. What are we talking about today?
We're talking about the IRA intelligence war with Michael Collins.
Okay, cool. This is the period of history you love, man. You love this war of independence stuff. You love what draws you to it?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's the development of a new type of warfare, which is intelligence-led urban guerrilla warfare.
Just yeah,
interesting to see it take place almost in real time. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, intelligence has been part of warfare since the beginning of time, right? And it honestly wins it wins wars, right? It really does. That people with the best intelligence, and there's some fascinating examples throughout history. But as the IRA developed in the, up to and kind of around World War One, and then beyond it, how was that structure built inside the IRA kind of thing? Was it something they'd taken from before, or was it something that kind of they fixed as they went along?
I suppose it's a bit of both, I mean, like, the precursors of the IRA and who existed alongside the IRA were the IRB. Mm-hmm. So the Fenian Brotherhood, like we talked in our previous podcast. These were essentially, if you're going to use a modern day representation, they'd be very similar to the CIA in an intelligence gathering organization. And they would have occasional sort of moments where they'd have outright rebellion or assassinations. But the IRA basically... The Irish Volunteers, which became the IRA, was essentially set up by the IRB, by Thomas Clarke, by Sean McDermott. And while they didn't take any sort of big roles in the IRA themselves, they were very high up in the IRB. And so they really sort of introduced the intelligence network structure. This was taken on by Michael Collins later on, developed, molded towards its task, particularly with regards counterintelligence and assassination.
Okay. Did a lot of these guys fight for the British in World War One, or were they so anti-British that they wouldn't do it? I assume some of them did, maybe not at the higher levels.
Yeah, well, I mean, quite a number of them were in the British Army, actually. And if we're going to look at, 1916, quite a lot of the high-end guys were former British Army soldiers.
Really?
Like, people didn't expect. So James Connolly, who was sort of an Irish Republican Socialist type, he was a member of the British Army. Michael Mallon, also one of those from his kind of political background as James Connolly, also remember the British Army and was very heavily decorated. Mm-hmm. Thomas Clarke, his father, was in the British Army. You had countless people. Even during the War of Independence, you had Tom Barry, British Army. And also, unfortunately, the person who actually killed Mike Collins in the end, O'Sullivan, was also a British Army sniper.
Really?
Yeah, they had to... The best thing for a guerrilla army is to know the techniques and tactics of the invading force, and that's what they did,
Yeah. You sit back and go, okay, these guys freaking hated the British. Why would they serve in the British Army? They probably grew up young men seeking adventure, no jobs, no future. You can't really blame them, right? There was no Irish Army. So I doubt a lot of them went there with an eye to using all those skills later on in a revolution, right? They probably just went for adventure and to do something that they were drawn to do, right?
Yeah, I think that was certainly a part of it. And I think that's something in military across the world that appealed to most young fellas, a sense of adventure, a sense of purpose.
Yep.
To live a life less normal.
Mm-hmm. Camaraderie, right? Kind of brotherhood, camaraderie, yeah. I wonder how Irish people... Sorry, go ahead.
But I think the big thing for the Irish that particular time, and it was very, very commonly mentioned, was by James Connolly, who again himself went into the British Army at a young age. It was conscription by starvation. So, I mean, like, they used to openly promote this on their recruitment posters in the British Army, that you had a higher chance of dying in the slums of Dublin from cholera or typhus than you would in the Somme, you know? So,
wow. Yeah. Conscription by starvation. Holy crap. I actually never heard that before. That's crazy, right? All right. So we're talking about Collins specifically. So let's talk about his early kind of years and how he became the top intelligence guy. He became very, very good at it, and actually became the top guy because he made, at least he was blamed or given credit, depending on what side you sit on, for the whole separation of the British from the south of Ireland into the north of Ireland. So he was the guy who had to make a decision and stamp the table. And I think he said at the time, somebody said, this probably marks your political death warrant or something. He said, it probably marks my actual death warrant. I don't know what the phrase was exactly, but it's something like that. So let's go back to the early days and kind of talk about how he ended up his journey.
Yeah, so Mike Collins was born in Cork, in a place called Sam's Cross, very rural agricultural area, in 1890. So this still is in the shadow of the Great Famine, the hunger, and that decimated. So he grew up, his father was a member of the IRB, he was a Fenian. But despite being, and I think you probably know this yourself, you know, from growing up in Ireland, you had a lot of people who were very, very intelligent, but they just weren't educated, you know?
Yeah, my mother was like that. My mother went to school, what they would call here, like primary school. And she actually never went to secondary school. So at the end of primary school, it would be something like middle school here. But she was a highly intelligent woman, man, and could organize things and was very, very smart, but just never had the education to fine-tune it, you know?
Yeah, same with my grandparents, you know. They never got any education outside primary school, but very smart. Mm-hmm. And Michael Collins' father was very similar. He was an amateur mathematician, incredibly well-read. And in fact, when the British, as a reprisal, burnt down his family home, they looked at all the books that they had in the home and were surprised that they were a brainy family from Cork, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's that kind of racist looking at a culture and giving them no credit that bites people in the ass when they have to fight them, right? And an example of that would be, people are going to hate this, but I think, and there's tons of examples throughout history, but I think because you underestimate the enemy. And the British did that in Northern Ireland for the whole time they were there. I think maybe near the end, they were like, holy crap, man, these guys know what they're doing. But there's examples of that throughout history. And it really is to your own detriment, man, I tell you, yeah.
And you know, it's funny, we were talking about in the last podcast with the Invincibles, they used to do this study of phrenology on the Irish, where they looked at the skull and they said, well, they're kind of deficient, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's no pat on the back if you're getting your ass kicked by a deficient.
That's true, right? Yeah. Yeah, but there's been examples of that throughout history, yeah. But I have seen that in my parents and grandparents, very highly intelligent people that just never got the education that would have really helped them.
Yeah. And Collins came from, again, like most Irish families, you know, a large family of around 8 tenant farmers. But he grew up in this kind of republic.
Oisin, just explain what tenant farmers are real quick.
So basically, you don't own the land. You're leasing out a very small plot of land to grow potatoes and subsist off of that, you know.
Right. So basically, before the British invaded Ireland, right, you did own the land, or your ancestors owned the land, right? And then the British came, took all the land, and then chopped it up into very small plots and rented it back to the people who previously owned the land, right? That's a tenant farmer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, you know, he grew up in this kind of Republican milieu there. Like, I mean, one of his most influential people that he met was the town blacksmith, James Santry, a guy whose entire family spent their lives in all the previous rebellions forging weapons for those rebellions. So he grew up with this kind of the mythos of a potential free Ireland, you know. But, you know, he got to a certain age, and like most fellas in Ireland, he realized there's no money here. There's no chance to get ahead. So he moved over to London and joined the civil service. Now, when he was in London, he was introduced to all these Irish kind of circles, like the Gaelic League, so the Irish language speaking league.
That's still there. That's still a thing, right?
Oh, it is, yeah.
The Gaelic League, yeah. Hmm.
And the London GAA as well. And in there, he met someone very, very important, a guy called Sam Maguire, which the name of the cup is after. Sam Maguire was a Protestant Irishman who lived in London and was a prominent member of the London IRB. So essentially, he brought him in at that young age, around, I think it was around 1910, he brought him into the IRB. And from there, he started to go up the ranks, start building up his reputation as a very intelligent young man, very, very high level of organizational skills. And by 1916, about 6 years after that, he'd risen up the ranks where he was financially advising armed shipments in via Count Plunkett. And had become, I would say, through the mechanisms of Thomas Clark, the mind behind the Fenian Brotherhood at the time, and Sean McDiarmid, who's a very close friend of his, and Tom Clark's protege, he was moved in to be the aide-de-camp of a very important man called Joseph Plunkett, one of the leaders of 1916. So while he was a junior enough guy in the IRA, he was a very, very well-connected member of the IRB.
Yeah, you're talking about...
Like 26 years old, right? He's up there, yeah, rubbing elbows with the top guys.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, like, you know, as we all know, the rising ends in failure. And Collins isn't
Oisin, can you talk through the Easter Rising? Just like the 2-minute version.
Sure, sure.
Just for people who don't know, right?
Yeah. So the 1916 Easter Rising is like the Irish version of the Alamo.
Or the Tet Offensive.
Tet Offensive,
right? Yeah. It was like open peace battle. Let's do this thing, right? At the time, the British Army were one of the most well-equipped and professional armies in the world. Probably standing toe-to-toe, not a great idea.
All right.
And the idea was there was supposed to be a nationwide rising, but because the Fenians, one of the weaknesses and the strengths of the Fenians is they're very, very secret. They put a figurehead in charge of the Irish Volunteers of the IRA, and he made a countermand order which totally scuppered their plans. So basically overnight it was reduced to a Dublin affair, and it was doomed like from the start, but they went ahead with it anyway because they realized there's probably, even if they all died, it was symbolic enough to invigorate the rest of them to go on ahead, you know.
And in kind of similarly to the Tet Offensive, it was a failed military operation, but it probably led more to the U.S. leaving the Vietnam than anything else, because people were like, holy crap, the American embassy in Saigon is being overrun, right? What the hell is going on? So it was, even though it was military failure, it did lead to the British leaving, probably more than any other mission. Is that correct?
I would say so. I think it was Tom Clark himself said it was the very first successful blow for Irish freedom. And I would say that in conjunction with the Irish War of Independence, it was probably the very first blow in the British Empire as a whole, because shortly after that, you start seeing India break away, the other colonies break away as well.
Yeah, and we talked about this before. It was also, you know, during World War One, there was that class system where they just churned working class over the trenches to get mowed down with machine guns, and people from all kind of colonies in the British Empire fought there, right? They were forced to fight there, and they got killed in huge numbers, and you saw people going, oh my God, this is ridiculous, you know, why are we doing this? How long did the Easter Rising last?
Just about a week, but you know, what you mentioned there earlier on was very true. This kind of idea of just moving men against bullets in World War One, they use that in the Rising as well. And there was a Fenian sniper called Frank Scholdeis, who did a memoir of it. And he couldn't get over that he killed about 50 men who just kept marching.
Yeah. It was old school tactics against new weapons. That's what it was, right? Yeah. You think like number 49 would have been, I'm not going out there. You can shoot me. I'm not doing it, right? But it's funny to look back in hindsight. Like, even the Civil War in America, like, they're all lined up in line shooting at each other. I'm like, nobody taught to lay down, right? Come on, man. old school tactics in World War One over the trend into machine guns changed everything, right? But people got mowed down, and working class people got mowed down. And it kind of changed a lot of mindsets in Pakistan and India and all these British colonies, you know? So it was a week long that basically took over some of the biggest buildings in Dublin, correct?
They took over some of the biggest buildings, and they also took over some strategically good ones as well. Like the GPO was the Telecommunication Center of Dublin, yeah, which they took over.
Yep.
The problem that some leaders had, which was, it was just a mistake, is they believed that the British would never shell the sister city of the empire, which is Dublin.
And they shelled the They did. They brought a gunboat up the Liffey, correct? And just hammered. And you can still see all the shell marks and bullet holes in a lot of those buildings. What's your buddy's name that does the walking tour?
Oh, Lorcan Collins.
Lorcan Collins, yeah. If you take that walking tour with him, he'll probably walk you past there, I assume, and he'll show all the bullets from the 1916 Rising, which is super cool. So they come up, the British hammered them, basically, and they're probably out of ammunition by the end of it. A lot of wounded. But a lot of Dubliners, Irish people in Dublin, were against the Rising, right?
Yeah. So a lot of people in Dublin, particularly in the sort of the slum areas there, were all the dependents, basically, the children and the wives of British soldiers.
Really?
Wow. And also you had Lunto, which was the biggest red light district, which and the biggest the biggest amount of people who actually pay money for a red light district in any country will be the soldiers.
Yeah, yeah. Hey! Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay, I resent that. I don't deny it, I just resent it. Where was that? Where was the red light district?
The Monto, so that was Montgomery Street. So it's just, it's not too far from the GPO. And it's not too far, you know, if the Rotunda area there as well, like biggest slum in Europe at the time, you know. So you created, it's almost like an abusive relationship. You make people dependent on you by abusing them and depriving them, but they'll never let you go because they're dependent on that little bit, you know.
Yep, yep. We see it to this day, and we see it in America. So, yeah, so they thought that the Brits would never shell the city. Did the Brits try to take back some of those buildings initially before they shelled the city, or did they just go to cannons right away?
No, they tried to take them back by force. They got ambushed a lot. So on Mount Street, but I think about 150 were killed trying to get over a bridge. They were realizing it was very difficult to get into an urban area, to attack an urban area.
Yeah, well, narrow streets that were not built. That's why this, some of the streets in Paris are huge. It's because after the French Revolution, where they lynched all the aristocracy, they built the streets big so it'd be harder to block. You know, interesting tidbit, right? That's so that right there, Oisin, that's useless information out. And some information you need to know as a doctor just went out of your head right there. But those old cities like Dublin that were built freaking, I don't know how many fucking 1,000 years ago, right? The Vikings freaking started Dublin, right? So that narrow streets, very easy to block. And there's very famous pictures, and we'll put one up on this, but on the YouTube channel, but of the Easter Rising where they had furniture and everything all blocking the streets. And then, of course, it's the home turf. It's the home turf for the Irish people there. They know all the best vantage points. They know, an urban fight is a hard fight anyway, especially against an enemy who knows the terrain better than you do, right? So the Brits, they come in, they try to take it. And then I guess they just said, screw this, man. Let's just fucking hammer it.
And essentially, the end result of 1916 was the main leaders, including Tom Clark, and importantly, Sean McDermott, who is probably one of the closest friends Michael Collins had in the IRB, were basically lined up along with the other signatories of the Proclamation of Independence and executed by a guy called Maxwell. Now, there was a decision to be made about other important members of the IRA at the time. Thankfully, Michael Collins was decided. To be very honest here, there was huge gaps in British intelligence. So despite, even to this modern day, I think the main goal of British of intelligence services overall is to give the impression they know everything at every time about everybody. But it's just not possible, and you miss huge gaps. So while they may have had up-to-date information on open organizations like the Irish Volunteers, or later to be called the IRA, they didn't have a huge amount of information on the IRB, the secretive underground organization. So they assumed Collins was a low-ranking member, and he wasn't sent off towards more secure facilities. He was sent off to a prison camp in Frongoch in Wales with other members, low-ranking members of the IRA.
And he was pretty high at that point.
But he was very high in the IRB, but they had no clue who he really was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They didn't even have a photograph of him, did they? Later on, because they didn't know what he looked like. Is that correct?
No, so it's interesting that I've heard that a few times before, but in fact, not only did they have photos of him, they had videos of him.
Okay, yeah.
And he was unusually tall for an Irish person, right? Because Irish people, right here, not like 6'2" normally, right? He's a big man, right?
He's about 6 foot even. Yeah. De Valera was very tall. De Valera was like 6'6". He was
really? Man, he stood out in a crowd, literally.
Oh, he did. If you ever see the photo of him as a young man, his father is Cuban, right? Mother is Irish.
Yeah.
But he's totally different from every other Irishman you've ever seen, you know?
Right. Yeah. So Collins gets shipped off. I mean, they executed all the leaders, right? Wasn't there a guy who was like so wounded, he was on a stretcher and they stood him up or something? Or they put him in a wheelchair and shot him?
So James Connolly got shot in the ankle and it had gone septic at that point. So they tied him to a chair and shot him in the chair.
Yeah.
Which at the time was seen as incredibly bad form in military surroundings to shoot an injured prisoner. I know it seems kind of counterproductive, but like, you know, to shoot an injured prisoner, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You know how many got executed?
Oh.
I don't want to put you on the spot.
So the initial signatories of the proclamation were executed. I think approximately 17 people were executed as well. They killed people who weren't even involved massively in the rising. So like poor Pierce's brother, Willie Pierce, was also executed, as well as people like McBride, who got involved in the rising on the day of, because he just really hated him for his role in the South African War when he was a commando out there.
Okay. So it eventually just got shelled and so much they surrendered, right? That's how they rolled them up.
Yeah, so that's how it happened. And the worst mistake the British made was that they shipped off all these young fellas to the one prison camp where they could educate each other and learn. Very similar to the troubles in the north when they send them off to the Long Kesh.
Yep. Yep.
They didn't
educate
themselves, you know?
Yeah. They still do that. Let's talk about intelligence on the battlefield, because here's one of the mistakes the British probably made, I assume, which have been made anytime you're an occupying force, right? That's not your home country, right? So intelligence people go in, they go for 6 months or a year, and then they go home, right? And we did this and everywhere, the US military did this everywhere we've ever been. It takes years and years to build up an intelligence network. And if you're switching people out on a regular basis because they have lives, then you're losing something every time you do that switchover. That's just the way it is. And the Brits probably did that. I know they had people living openly in Dublin, like intelligence aid, and they weren't behind secure walls either. They were openly living in houses in Dublin, correct?
Well, so it's interesting you say that. So they had several different arms of intelligence out in Ireland. So they had the RIC, which was the cornerstone of their intelligence network. Mm-hmm. Most people, they think, that's just police. But the RIC were basically a paramilitary force.
What does that stand for?
Royal Irish Constabulary.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, their counterparts became obviously the RUC in the north, but
yeah,
they were a paramilitary force, and they were basically constantly surveilling the local population. Now, they had specialized groups like G Division, which were for political and counterinsurgency work. They had Dublin Castle, where you had basically MI6 was working out of there, and then you had British Army intelligence as well, you know.
Were they talking to each other, do you know? A lot of times these different networks, they're all trying to hug the information. And this is what happened on 9/11 in America. They're all trying to keep their little thing secret, and they're not really cross-promoting and, you know, talking to each other. And they all have the same information in different ways. And that's how intelligence is done, right? I take a little bit here and a little bit here and a little bit here, but none of those pieces mean anything unless I put them all together. And they probably weren't putting them all together very often. That's kind of how it happens.
That's very true. I mean, like, not all, it's same back then as now in any theater of war. I mean, like, I think it's safe to assume in every organization, everyone's infiltrated to a certain degree. Not all organizations are uniformly on the same page. There are doves and hawks in both of them. And sometimes they're actually working against each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that has happened throughout Northern Ireland and a lot of theaters around the world, right? So Colin, how long did he go to prison in Wales?
So they let him out really early because they thought he was such a junior member. He got out around December of that year.
Really?
So he's only a couple of years in there.
That's a light sentence for a revolution. Wow.
The thing is, though, they thought he was such a junior member, they thought he'd be no harm at all. And the more senior, serious political and revolutionary people were held for much longer.
Yeah.
So, for example, De Valera, who's much higher up in the IRA, but nowhere involved really in the IRB, was sentenced to a maximum security prison. He had to be broken out by Collins'
that's
men.
Right. Later.
Yeah, that's a great story, too. But so he only did a couple of months and he got out. What happened then?
So it was very interesting. So as I was saying earlier on, Collins was very tightly connected with the leadership of the IRB, who really are, you know, they're the Fenian Brotherhood. They're the people behind this whole rising. So he was a close friend of Sean McDermida, who was Tom Clark's protege. And when Tom Clark was executed, for the very first time, the Fenian Brotherhood had a female leader, which was Kathleen Clark, his wife. He basically had entrusted his wife with all the details to hand over to the next person. And Kathleen Clark put Michael Collins in charge of the National Aid and Volunteers Dependence Fund, which was basically financial networking to arm a rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So he signed off, and this is where you'll see the video of him signing off the first national loan, where he's helping people get back to work after the rising, you know? Mm-hmm. But in reality, he's trying to source money to fund a revolution. And basically between 1916 and 1918, he's setting up his intelligence network. He's working alongside another young fella called Liam Tobin, his second in command. And they're getting spies, multiple spies, in Dublin Castle, people like Nelligan. In G Division, they're getting people like Broy. And they're getting lots of different people through innocuous means. So like people who work in society pages, photographers. Anytime people would sit down for a photo, a soldier with a pretty woman, take a photo. I know who you are now. I know where you're living and who your inner circle is, you know.
Mm-hmm. They had a woman. They had a woman in Dublin Castle, right? She was a cleaner or something like that, who gave them a lot of intelligence. Women are awesome at intelligence. They just are, because mistakenly people think they're a low threat, and that's just not true. Anybody who's been married knows that. I'm kidding, but they're very, very good, because men act stupid around women. It's in our DNA, and men like to freaking talk, and women are awesome at intelligence. And people who now even say, oh, women shouldn't be in special operations and women shouldn't do this and this. Do you ever see two Green Berets walking around a shopping mall in the Middle East trying to look normal with their tattoos, and they're freaking walking around, they're all jacked up, and they're like, but a woman, nobody passes an eye, and you know, so women are awesome at intelligence. They're really, really good at it, and the fact that they were employing them is just smart, and the fact that they put one in charge is really smart too, because, you know, as she's less likely to get picked up, she's less likely to get interned, and you have that continuity there. You know, somebody that's going to be there if there's a big sweep and they all get sent to prison, right? You have that continuity. That's wicked smart.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was going to say, I mean, like that same woman that you're talking about, she used to be a typewriter for them. So she'd be making copies of every single document of importance.
Yeah.
She also basically, they started... Over the course of 1918 to 1919, started picking off G Division, started dismantling G Division through assassination, intimidation, etc. And so they started bringing in people from Belfast to head up the operations in Dublin. So they brought this guy Redmond, head of RIC Special Branch in Belfast, to come in and shake things up. Within 2 weeks, due to the information given by that woman, Paddy Daly, the head of Mike Collins' squad, assassinated them.
Wow. Yeah.
Two up in the capital and killed, you know.
Yeah. That's hey, I got a new job. Woohoo! 2 weeks. Boom. All right. Intel rules the battlefield. It just does. At what point did the Cairo gang show up? And, you know, you had the 12 apostles assassinate. What kind of time frame are we talking about there? Are we jumping ahead? If I'm jumping ahead, just we'll get to it. But Collins gets out of prison in Wales and sets up this finance network. From there.
So we're saying like probably from 1919 to 1920, things are trying to ramp up. So British intelligence are realizing there's something different happening here that they hadn't seen in a long while. And you know, it was Fenianism. It was basically the Fenians of old, that they're saying tactics of assassination. It wasn't open warfare. It was intelligence-led covert killings of high-end military, police, and political leaders.
Was there any effort to win the hearts and minds of the Irish people?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. Like, so I was talking about, you know, that there's doves and hawks, right?
Yeah.
Some came in there. So there's several people who were sent in to fix things. There was Alan Bell, who was there to, he was a financial analyst, and he was there to basically nip the financial support for the IRA.
Yeah.
Very complex banking networks. Collins realized who he was immediately and executed him when about a month into him being in Dublin.
Yeah.
To make sure that, because finance, again, is essential for any insurgency.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then there was two other people, sort of like the counterparts of each other. There was Andy Cope, who is the dove, essentially, in this thing, where he realized, maybe this person I can talk with and we can get a negotiated settlement. Because he was realizing there's no chance of having an overt victory here, military victory with these people. And then there was the other one, the other extreme, is a guy called Ormond Winters, codenamed O, who's most certainly a hawk. Now, his phrase toward the Irish people, which pervaded most of the War of Independence, he said, the Irish people have the characteristics of a dog and need to be treated with a firm hand. So, you know, basically Ormond Winters probably had most control over the War of Independence. But as you'll see as the story goes on, probably Andy Cope's the reason why there was a truce in the end.
Okay. Yeah. Was there a publication that the IRA had at that, IRB had at that point to try to spread propaganda, essentially, or get the message out? Like they had later on with, you know, Republican News on Fublock was the newspaper of the IRA later on.
I think they had on Fublock back then too.
They did. Yeah.
There's a couple, the Fenians had a ton of publications, but I think on Fublock was back then as well. But, you know, it's funny, like, I mean, even Collins, despite how good he was also infiltrated as well. So, I mean, like, the British had sent in a spy by the name, his real name was Jack Byrne, but he went by the alias Jameson. And he was basically he was a British Army soldier. He had already infiltrated the London circles of the GAA and the Irish Language Society, those soft things that you can get into without really committing to something. And he was brought over, all the right credentials, brought over to Dublin to meet with someone who was involved in the IRB. At that point, people knew what Collins looked like, they didn't know what his actual role was. They realized he was involved in finance somehow, but they didn't realize he was essentially the director of IRA intelligence. Mm. So Jameson met with him and realized really quickly, everyone in the room is treating this guy with a lot of respect. This guy is important. And he was offering Collins a lot of weapons. So Collins was interested in him. But the people around Collins, particularly Liam Tobin, didn't trust him. In fact, Tobin wanted to execute him straight away. He's like, this guy's trouble. Now, what Tobin did was essentially distance Collins from him and started feeding him a lot of false information about where to meet Collins. Sure enough, everywhere he said he was going to be met by Collins got raided by military. So he knew he was the rat. Mm-hmm. So basically, he came down a laneway, put him on his knees, said, we believe you're a spy, protested the very last minute, and then she said, God save England, and he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's the way it goes, unfortunately.
Dude, that's a ballsy job. I mean, I don't care if you support the IRA or what side you're on, that takes some freaking courage, knowing that to travel in those circles, knowing that even if there's an inkling that you're a spy, they'll err on the side of caution and put a bullet in you, right? So that takes some freaking courage. It really does. I remember talking to one of the British guys who was in Somalia with me. It was he did intelligence work in Northern Ireland. He said, it's scary. And he'd fought in the Falklands, man. He's an older guy. He's like, the scariest thing he ever did was walk into a fucking IRA pub in Ireland. He's like, I was terrible. And this is no weak man. He was a huge dude, too. And he was a badass. But he was like, I was fucking scared. Yeah, that takes some balls, man. You got to respect that. You go in here, I'm gonna play it. And people do it today. People do it in the military. People do it on the law enforcement. Do it undercover. Cops do it all the time. that the risk may not be as much, but it still takes a lot of guts because you got to play that role and you got to play it perfect. You know, I could have. It's funny because when you're in special operations, you kind of, and it may not always be that, you kind of hit a crossroads, right? And you can kind of go this way and be a sniper and a door kicker and a breacher and do all that fucking bang, bang, bang stuff. Or you can kind of veer this way and do intelligence and run sources and all kinds of stuff. I never thought I would be good at that. So I went this way. And it's very hard to come back, right? Because they invest all these things in all these schools for you. Either way you go. So once you're on that path, it's very hard to veer back. But I never, number one, it didn't interest me. Number two, I didn't think I'd be good at it. And I'm obviously pretty chatty, but I think I wanted to do this other path more. But I think in a lot of ways, that is the easier path, right? Put the charge on the door. Hope you built it properly. Breach the door. Go in. CQB, sniper, military free fall. They're all very tangible skills. That this intel thing is a very, very fluid thing, man, because it's all personality and you gotta manipulate people and be good at that. And I just never thought I'd be good at it, honestly. But I have a lot of respect for people who do it because it is tough. Where was the money coming at this point? Was it coming from America and Australia for the IRB?
It's predominantly coming from America. It was also coming heavily from London, a lot of Irish in London.
Yeah.
And other places like Australia, Canada, other places like that. But yeah, predominantly, you know, America, yeah, even to the most modern iteration of the IRA with NORAD and all these other groups, funding came from America.
Yeah, from pubs in Boston and New York and places like that, man. Yep. Yep. I remember being in pubs in London, New York, and they passed the Irish pub, they passed the can around for freaking NORAD, right? I was like, what's this? All right. So he's got good intelligence. What happened to the, like you said, he got infiltrated. How did the that was one way, right? Were there other infiltrations that got close to him?
It's hard to say, right? So, the gentleman, while Ormond Winters is heading up essentially assassination units like the Cairo Gang and another group, lesser well-known, the Iago Gang, to kill Collins,
yeah,
which were basically a special operations unit of their day, intelligence-led, yeah, to kill. Andy Cope was the dove, like, you know, that kind, yeah, of mixed civil servant and intelligence work.
Yeah.
Where he met up with Collins and was having constant negotiations and talks with him. So, it very similar to the most recent issues with Division IRA. Despite people saying we don't deal with terrorists,
yeah,
they're always talking with them.
Even Thatcher, who was a hardliner, she was talking to them. You know what I mean? Just politically, they don't advertise it. Talk to me about the Cairo Gang, where they got their name and what their job was when they came into Ireland.
Yeah, so the Cairo Gang, again, it was Ormond Winters' brainchild, essentially. Very similar to the MRF in the north. Basically, these are plainclothes soldiers would be considered the elite of their background with regards to intelligence networking. Most of them were brought back from Mesopotamia, so modern-day Iraq, brought in from Egypt as well. A lot of people think they get the name because a lot of them are from the Egyptian side of things, Cairo Gang, but in fact, they had a front called the Cairo Cafe on Grafton Street, mm-hmm, where they would go through dossiers of political leaders they're going to assassinate, essentially. So a lot of Sinn Féin people they're going to bump off. And they went through all their little kill packs in the Cairo Cafe. Now, the Cairo Cafe is only about a 15-minute walk away from the Confession Box, which is a bar which Mike Collins worked out of. Collins basically ordered the squad to essentially eliminate the Cairo Gang.
And you heard they got the intelligence? I mean, it's probably that whole network, right? The woman who worked in Dublin Castle. It's probably a lot of different things, right?
There was Nelligan. There was several people working in Dublin Castle. But it was a combination of pooling resources, essentially. Now, they knew, and to be honest with you, I would say a considerable amount of intelligence came from London division of the IRB as well, under Sam Maguire, who's head of intelligence there.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew who these guys were before they got on the boat.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
So the Collins had a hit squad called the 12 Apostles, right?
That's right.
There's a great video on YouTube. I'm going to try to get my wife to splice it in here, but of a guy called Vinnie Byrne, who's like old as dirt in the video, but he was like, he's talking about hitting these guys, which is crazy.
He went up to the hall door, knocked at the door, and a maid opened the door, and I said, could I see Captain Bennett? Or she said, he's in bed, so he's very important, I must see him. We brought down Bennett down to Ames, and I said to them, you know you're British spies. You know the consequences if you're caught as a spy is death. I said, that's what's going to happen to you two men now. The Lord have mercy on your souls. So the two of them were shot.
Like, you know, this here, where is it at?
Well, the Webley.
This is what was used on a lot of them, right? The Webley pistol. This thing's a classic, and it was a gift from a friend of mine, but the old Webley pistol, this was like very, very pertinent at the time. Double action revolver, actually ahead of its time, but this would have been one of the guns mostly used. I'm sure there were others, but that was a very prominent handgun at the time.
Yeah, they were big into the Webley and the 45 ACP round as well.
Right, yeah.
And that was a new gun back then. That came out in 1911, right? Mausers, I've seen some Mausers on some stuff as well. The pistol with a mag on it, you know. I love old school guns. So they hit all these guys in one day, right? They went basically simultaneously and hit all this Cairo gang and killed them all instantly, right?
That's right. So basically, bear in mind, at this point, Collins is in, and this is at the height of the war, Collins is in intense negotiations with this guy, Andy Cope, the dove, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when you're in negotiations, number one, you realize you have to be at a place of strength.
Mm-hmm. And
secondly, the other guy is still out to kill you.
Yeah.
And realize that if he let his guard down for a second, these people would wipe him out. Mm. So get your revenge in first, so to speak. So Collins basically organized a simultaneous hit, early hours of the morning, basically killed, the British report 14 of their intelligence officers being wiped out. IRA reports at the time may even double that, you know.
Mm.
Now, what happened shortly afterwards was that not everybody got away. Three men were captured the following day, arrested the following day.
Three of the hit squad?
Well, this is the thing. So two people who were involved in the IRA, potentially one involved in the hit squad, and another guy who's just a civilian. So it was guy McKee Clancy, IRA, and then McClune, who was just an Irish language enthusiast, who was captured.
Mm-hmm.
So they were brought to this place called the Fingernail Factory. It's on Parliament Street, and it's just across the street from Crow Street, where Collins' headquarters are,
mm-hmm.
Right beside Dublin Castle. And Ormond Winters had a particular guy he went to for interrogations, a guy called Hoppy Hardy. Hoppy Hardy was called Hoppy because he lost his leg in the Somme and would walk with a hop. He had an artificial limb. And Hardy basically tortured these guys until they died. They died too quickly to give any information. And the intelligence people who had infiltrated that and had witnessed the torture said they had bayoneted him from throat to genitals. And basically, Hoppy Hardy was standing over the body screaming, hitting them with a gun while they're already dead. You know, this guy was already...
Psychopath, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what the people had learned while they were observing their comrades being tortured was that the British had planned to drive into Croke Park for what was going to be known as Bloody Sunday. So they quickly got word to Dublin Brigade, but it was too late. British regular troops had already driven into Croke Park during the football match where Tipperary was playing and had opened fire on the civilian crowd, mm-hmm. killing 14 people.
Yeah, there was two Bloody Sundays, and they get mixed up sometimes. This was the first one. How many people were killed?
14. 14 okay. People were killed.
So you're talking about a basically old-school armored vehicle, I think, pulled in and just hosed the whole place down with a Vickers machine gun, right? As retaliation for those hits.
Yeah, sort of a collective punishment, you know?
Yeah, stupid thing to do. Huge mistake. You want to turn the whole population against you? Do some stupid shit like that.
Massive problem. And it's funny, it was commonplace in the British Empire at the time. Just about a year before that, in India, they did the same thing with the Amritsar massacre, where they opened fire on a bunch of Sikhs. You know, if you ever talk to Sikhs today, they'll still not forgive them for that. You know, that was...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beat the Indians, you know? So essentially, it worked in Collins' favor almost that this happened. Public opinion was even hardened, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, if you think back in 1918, 2 years before this, the Irish population, 85% of the entire country, voted overwhelmingly for Sinn Féin in the general election. Now, they weren't voting for armed rebellion. They were just voting for this vague idea of freedom, right? But now people were saying, no, 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 we can't do this politically. We have to do this by physical force.
Yeah, I think it gives you a look into the mindset of the enemy, right? If they're willing to do this, then there's no talking to them, right? At what level was that decision made?
That was at a high-end decision. That was Ormond Winters with Express. And you'll never see this because the British intelligence files are sealed for another 250 years.
Wow. Did it come from Churchill?
I would say it either came from Churchill or from Lloyd George himself.
Yeah. What was Churchill's role at this point?
Churchill was basically, Ormond Winters and Churchill were very close. Churchill essentially approved and created the auxiliary division that tortured and maimed throughout Ireland. He had approved the Black and Tans, even though it wasn't his idea.
Talk to me about the Black and Tans real quick.
Black and Tans were ex-soldiers that had served on multiple fronts. They had mixed uniforms because of a lack of uniform there. They're heavily armed. They had to be battle-hardened and have a certain rank to get in there. Mm-hmm. So they were more experienced soldiers. What I would say is that Churchill had mentioned, and I love the way the British do have these sayings. He says, we want a purposeful regime of frightfulness for the Irish people.
Wow. Which means
we want state-sponsored terrorism.
A terror squad. And there's a misconception that the Black and Tans were criminals that were released from prison in England. You know what I mean? They were combat veterans who liked what they did and were pretty much gloves off. Right, kind of go to Ireland and do your thing, right?
As bad as the Black and Tans are, and they did some serious atrocities, most of the atrocities, like the ones that really stand out, were done by the auxiliaries. And the auxiliaries were specifically trained for counterinsurgency work. So like the burning and sacking of Cork, like, I mean, again, a lot of these collective punishments, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Balbriggan too, right? Balbriggan was burned to the ground, right? Yep. I think... Yeah, I tell you, counterinsurgency is a freaking difficult fight. It just is, because you can't be weak, but you overplay your hand, which the American military have done that. You overplay your hand, you come in too strong, you turn the whole fucking population against you, right? But there's a balance, right? You have to fucking win the hearts and minds, but you can't be wuss. You gotta hit back, and it's a tough fight to win. And if that local population are willing to fight the long fight, it's very, because it drains that occupying force for years and years and years and decades and sometimes, right? It's a difficult fight. And then you get soldiers who overplay, they do something, and if that came from the top, it was really dumb, but sometimes soldiers on the ground. And I think the Bloody Sunday in 1972 was more of a on-the-ground decision by like a battalion commander, maybe. I don't think that came from higher, but I might be wrong, but you get that, and it just turns everything on its freaking head. So they come in, they drive in, they bust through the gates, they go to a football match, Gaelic football match, and they spray the crowd down and kill 14 people, you said. Yeah. Was it 14?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Then what?
So then...
What year was that? I'm sorry, what year was that?
That was July 1921.
21, okay, yeah. And it was probably a turning point, because it wasn't that long after that the British were like, we're out. Right.
Yeah, I mean, like, retaliation was very swift with Collins. Collins found who had ratted out Clancy and McKee, and also this other fella, Clun, who was also tortured to death. Guy called Shankers used to hang around. He was a former British Army soldier himself. He used to hang around the Monto quite a bit and had followed these guys as they were coming back home to their lodgings. Basically, Vinnie Byrne himself found out which bar Shankers used to go in to have his morning shot, and he walked right behind him, shot him back in the head. And, you know, that's how he ended that.
Yeah.
Basically, the violence started escalating and escalating. The Cairo gang was wiped out, so they brought in the Igo gang. And bear in mind, There's a lot of players in this. So during this period of time, people like Dan Breen and Sean Tracy and all the rest were being co-adopted into the squad, essentially, you know. They're full-time guerrilla warfare.
Yeah, we're kind of concentrated on Collins, but that was Dublin. But pretty much throughout the country, there was these flying squads hitting the British, hit-and-run tactics, right?
Yeah. And like, Breen was brought into Dublin to do a bit of work for Collins as well, which is kind of interesting because the Igo gang was being headed up by another fella. But one of the sections of it was being headed by a guy called Smith. Smith's brother had been killed in Cork by Sandy O'Donovan, a friend of Collins, funny enough. And basically, his brother had this famous saying, you know, the more you shoot, the better I like you. You may make mistakes, but I can assure you that no one's going to be held to account if you kill a civilian. Basically, Sandy O'Donovan walked into the man's house, pointed a gun at him and said, orders were to shoot on sight, you're in our sights, prepared to die, and killed him. Mm. But unfortunately for Dan Breen has been blamed for everything at that point. Yeah. So they set up the Igo gang as well to kill him. Your man's brother was heading up that unit of the Igo gang and attacked Dan Breen in the Fernside. Dan Breen escaped, killed the brother as well, and went on his way. You know, so it was really brutal, close quarters fighting in an urban environment for the following year.
If I could go back in time, I'd go back and put a GoPro camera on Dan Breen, because that he was a bad fucker, man, and he was just hard. Yeah, that was a tough man. We talked about him in one of the last podcasts, man. What a freaking awesome guy. All right, so retaliation. I assume all the hits kind of ramped up after Bloody Sunday, and at some point. I mean, I know negotiations were going on, ongoing the whole time, but at some point the Brits pulled Collins, right, a small delegation out. They went to England, I think, to get the offer.
So when that happened, for the Doves and the Hawks on the British side, there's also the Doves and the Hawks on the Irish side. At this point, right after Bloody Sunday, De Valera, who is doing this sort of goodwill tour of the United States at the moment as the president of Ireland, realized probably time to come home. So he came back, and he came back into an Ireland which had changed quite a lot. Now, there are some historians that look very negatively on De Valera, like people like Tim Pat Coogan. But, you know, I think he's a bit biased in some ways. He's no one's all good or all bad. They just came with different opinions, you know. Mm-hmm. So De Valera came back, and he had heard that a lot of people were calling, you know, the IRA murder gangs and so on. He didn't like it, and he thought there should be sort of a more open kind of warfare. Which doesn't make sense, really, because, you know, a small nation against the entire British Empire is not going to work.
No.
Mm-hmm. No. It's not going to work. Now, he did have one or two good ideas. Now, during the middle of the negotiations in England, De Valera organized what the IRA would classify, and they've classified in later things in the 80s, 90s, and all the rest with the provisionals, is what they call a spectacular. And basically, they destroyed the customs house. They burnt it to a crisp. Mm-hmm. And that was a massive attack on a financial center, which, you know, it did make a big difference. But the problem is it also got a lot of guys rolled up, a lot of important members of the IRA rolled up because of it, because it was a daylight attack. And Collins was furious about it. Now, the British intelligence didn't realize how badly that it may have affected Collins' operations. But I think it did factor into Collins accepting the truce. Collins probably realized some essential members of mine got rolled up because of this operation. I'm going to probably be more compliant with some of the negotiations. Now, that being said, you know, it's very much like towards the end of the 90s with the provisionals. People are always wondering how infiltrated people are. They're talking to British intelligence. Are they being seduced? Are they being, like, you know, turned? Like, Collins hid for a very, like, it was hidden by Collins up until his death that he was talking with Andy Cope prior to the truce. But I think what's more telling is his conversations with a guy called Roger McCorley, who is head of Belfast Brigade of the IRA. So a really high up member of the Northern Division of the IRA during the truce. He's basically telling Roger McCorley, along with other members of the Northern Division of the IRA, is like, look, this is probably what's going to happen. They're probably going to keep this. We hold tight for now, but we'll get the weapons, we'll get rearmed, and we'll go into the north by force. Because everyone sort of, and I think there's sort of, either demonization or sanitization of Michael Collins. Like you look at political parties now that want to claim him, like Fine Gael, they'd be saying, well, Collins was just hoping for a stepping stone, which would be a political stepping stone. It's like, that's not really his style. I mean, like, his style would have been, we'll hold on for now, and then we get the arms, we're going to go in by force. You know, make Belfast the next Dublin, essentially. And what makes me, what sort of furthers my belief in this is that after the truce was done and dusted, and as you said yourself, he signed his own death warrant, he was trying his best to prevent a civil war from breaking out. And you better believe British intelligence were probably stoking both sides mm-hmm. to try and get a civil war breakout.
Yeah.
Now, during this period of time, they put a guy called Henry Wilson in charge of the North. Now, Henry Wilson was...
The IRA did, or the Irish or the British?
The British. The British put this guy, Henry mm-hmm. Wilson, in there. Now, he was just one of the worst people to have in there, really. Basically, he ordered pogroms of the Irish population in the North. So mass killings. Mm. Basically, population control, pushing them down into Monaghan and Louth and to other places out of Belfast.
Catholics.
Mm-hmm. And so Collins basically said, essentially, if I'm going to keep Northern Division of the IRA on side and make sure this doesn't break off, I'm going to have to kill Henry Wilson, even though I've already agreed to a truce. So two IRA members, a guy called Reginald Dunn and Joseph O'Sullivan, both World War One vets from the Somme, one missing his leg, assassinated Henry Wilson in London after the truce. They had a biplane waiting for them to get away. Unfortunately, because of Reginald's amputation, they couldn't actually physically get out of there quick enough. Mm. They were arrested and hanged. And shortly after their hanging, you know, the Irish Civil War did break out, you know. Again, you know, the sad thing about it is during the Civil War, it's probably the most regretful aspect of Irish history. Because you had two sides, both wanting more or less the same thing, having different approaches for it, and killing each other.
Just go back, Oisin, real quick for people to understand. So Collins goes to England and he agrees to basically a truce. It wasn't even the British leaving. They left the south of Ireland and stayed in Northern Ireland. And he saw that as a stepping stone. And we could launch in there with weapons and all that. And a lot of people thought he sold out the North, right? Now, you know, had he held firm, the war might have went on for decades. Had he, I mean, you just don't know, right? You make a decision and you move on. And why was De Valera not in London doing this?
A very good question. There's a lot of debate on that. I'm assuming he probably predicted that the negotiations would not end in anything meaningful. It would be a total failure of negotiations. And he didn't want to be associated with a failure.
Yeah.
He probably didn't expect Collins to actually make a decision. I honestly think he underestimated Collins' notion that he was a negotiator, and he probably thought Collins would just say, "This is not my bag. I'm going to leave it and walk out."
Yeah,
I think as a politician, De Valera didn't want to be associated with that failure.
That's a bit of a dick move.
It was poor. I mean, I think we will look back on De Valera and Collins and look at both their strengths and weaknesses. I think De Valera probably is the most capable political mind that Ireland had produced at that point. But certainly he didn't really have the instinct for intelligence work, nor did he have any sort of real military ability either. You know?
Yeah. So what when this split, right? So Collins comes back, the British leave the south of Ireland, becomes the Republic of Ireland, right? They take the hand over there at Collins Barracks in Dublin, right? Which you wouldn't call that, I'm sure, at the time, where I've done training, which is a museum now. Doesn't make you feel old at all when you did training at a base that is now a museum. And it was ghetto as hell, dude. It was ghetto. I'd love to go back there, man. I got to go back there because, you can tour it now. But so at that point, what was the split? So when you had the people who supported Collins, what were they known as?
So they were known as pro-treaty.
Okay.
Free staters and the other guys?
Anti-treaty or rebels.
Okay. So now you have the people who are all fighting in the one cause are now split in half. And some people who actually liked Collins and were loyal to Collins were now against him. Right, Dan Breen, I think, was against him, right? And he has said that he actually liked Collins and respected him, but he didn't want this treaty. They saw it as selling out the North and settling, and they just want the British out, right? So now you have a broken system with two opposing sides. Do we know what the split was in percentage-wise?
Very hard to say. I mean, like, So I think I would say it's very hard to say. There's a lot of people who definitively took a side either way. And there's some people who just said, I don't want any part to do with this. And it's just left the scene, you know?
Yeah.
They won't be involved in killing their former comrades.
Right.
I think the interesting thing was there was even splits within the squad itself. So people like Paddy Daly, right? Who, you know, unusual for the squad. He was he was a widower. He had multiple kids. He was very committed. And then you had people like Sean Lamass, became a future Taoiseach of Ireland, also in the squad. And he went the opposite way. He joined Fianna Fáil, was anti-treaty IRA. And, you know, to make things even more sad, like Sean Lamass's brother, who had very little to do with it, Noel Lamass, was captured by Neligan, brought up with the little man's tortured to death, killed. You know, I mean, like, that's the kind of civil war you had there. You
yeah.
know?
And, you know, you say the American Civil War is brother against brother, but this really was brother against brother, like, literally, because it was just so much smaller and contained.
I was just saying, the people who are really loyal to Collins, like Daly, Neligan, Broy, it's no surprise they were so brutal after he was killed. So when he was killed in Bail na Blaw, basically these people, it's a good thing the British didn't kill him, because if they did assassinate him, that anger would have been directed at them. The British did a masterstroke there with fermenting a civil war, because the actual anger was directed at some of the best and brightest from the Republican movement.
Right.
Other members of the Republican movement. So like Paddy Daly was involved in some atrocity out in Kerry called the Ballyseedy Massacre, which probably deserves a podcast all of its own. Oriel House was set up by like Liam Tobin, which was like, you know, a lot of torture went on there.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys were really brutal towards their own people. And later on, you can see these fellas, after all of this, being very disillusioned. People like Liam Tobin, who, you know, was very disillusioned, you know.
Right. So when the split happened, anti-treaty, pro-treaty, they had a set-piece battle in Dublin, right? At least one, where they actually fought toe-to-toe and did an open battle against each other. Did the British leave a lot of weapons behind that the pro-treaty people fell in on and became the Irish Army, basically?
The British actually supplied them with the weapons.
Really?
So they actually supplied them with the shells they could shell the forecourts with. They essentially, you know, realized that they could get these people to do their job for them.
Right. And they didn't want these rebels going into the north, I assume. So if the Irish army at that point could kill them all, it would make the north safer. I suppose that's what they were thinking, right?
I think the big idea was, I think the whole idea of the north essentially was for the British to have a foothold in Ireland. And they wanted to make sure that the idea of the south or the 26 counties here would never really get off the ground financially, economically, and political stability-wise, and that it would collapse into a heap, and eventually they'd be there in the north, and they just reunify the country under their rule again.
Yeah, pretty arrogant. What was in the north for them? Why did they want to keep the north?
I think the main reason was, as I said, it was a foothold they could have to get the rest of the country back. But secondly, they had some profitable things there at the turn of the century. They had shipbuilding, they had linen works.
The Titanic was built in Belfast. Not a great thing to put on your resume, by the way, but it was built there.
The ship that sank. It's a ship that sank and the most blown up hotel. You know, I mean, like.
But you had a lot of tenant farmers that were Protestant, right, that wanted to stay a part of England, right?
Yeah, I mean, and inversely, you also had a lot of English people who were very pro-Irish Republic as well. You had people like Erskine Childers, who was, you know, he was British. I mean, like, he was raised in England. He grew up there. His family, obviously, he had land here in Ireland. He started seeing the deprivation here and felt sympathy for the cause and became not only a member of the IRA, but a member of the anti-treaty IRA. The British really wanted to kill him, which they succeeded in doing via Free State Forces. You know, he was executed.
Okay. So Collins, he was the commander-in-chief then at that point, right, of the Irish army, basically. And why did he go to Cork when he went down, when he was killed in ambush? What was that trip to Cork for? Was he going home or what?
Well, no, there's a lot of suspicion about that. I think he was actually going to talk to Liam Lynch.
Okay.
I think Liam Lynch was, people talk about De Valera as a counterpart to Michael Collins, but I don't think that's correct. I think Liam Lynch truly is the military counterpart to Michael Collins. Liam Lynch was an incredibly effective rural guerrilla warfare leader, anti-treaty politics, right? And just all around quite excellent in what he did, which was ambushing British soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Collins himself liked each other a great deal. And I think if Collins and himself actually sat down and met, I think some negotiation settlement would have taken place. But he was ambushed and he was killed in Bail and Law.
Yeah. Collins, from history, was a very personable guy, right? Very likable guy, very, you know, he's just one of those guys that was able to talk and get on with people, right? From what I've read and seen, right? So they're rolling in convoy, right? I think they did an armored vehicle or something with them, right?
Yeah.
And they got ambushed in a kind of lonely Cork area. I think that vehicle is still around. I think that vehicle is actually in a museum in the Cork, I think. Am I right there?
You're right, yeah.
The one with the Vickers machine gun on it and all that?
Yeah. So Collins was an intelligence man. He was not a soldier in the sense that he didn't have military training, but he had people around him who did have military training. And he decided, instead of driving through the ambush, to shoot back.
Yeah.
And Sonny O'Neill, the British Army sniper and IRA volunteer, shot him, you know, shot him in the head. You know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about, was he shot by someone in his convoy or whatever? There seems to be two different sides. Like, in reality, it's just the entry and exit wound look different, and they always do, you know? Mm. So, I mean...
Yeah, bullets do weird things. Like, yeah, the worst thing you can do is stop in an ambush site, right? If at all possible, you put the pedal to the metal and you go like a bat out of hell and get through the kill zone, right? So they stopped. In the ambush line and fought. And did everybody get killed in the ambush or just a few?
Just Collins.
Yeah, he was the only one?
I think really? He was the only one. A few people were injured, but I think Collins was the one who was... Yeah.
So... ambushed by anti-treaty forces, Collins is dead. How do we get back on track? How did the Irish government squash the anti-treaty forces and move the hell on with their lives, basically? How did that happen and how long did it take?
It took a while now. I mean, like, you had a civil war that took place and like, I suppose civil war, best left to another podcast, but essentially, I would say it was a series of atrocities that took place that really had to stamp out that sort of anti-treaty sentiment.
Was it tit-for-tat killings kind of thing?
It was more tat.
Was it? It was the registered government going, okay, you're anti-treaty, whack, 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 right? That, okay, wow, hit squads.
Paddy Daly, and then bear in mind, like, Paddy Daly, and all the accounts will say this, that guy had severe post-traumatic stress kind of stuff going on after. Like, he was a fairly damaged individual going into the Civil War. And he wasn't taking any prisoners, literally. Like, in the Ballyseedy massacre, he tied people to landmines and set them off, like, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, you're damaged goods, brother. What happened to him?
Yeah, well, he survived. I mean, like, a lot of these guys were really just a little bit warped by the whole experience. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, I think it kind of did get rolled up by the execution. So, like, The Irish government at the time, the Free State Forces, had 77 executions of Irish IRA volunteers.
Wow.
So, I mean, that quietened things down. So, essentially, that kind of... The sad thing about it, though, is when you think about it, is this is all stuff taking place in the South. This is in the North we're talking about.
Yeah. Hmm.
In the North, a lot of people were very loyal to Collins, like incredibly loyal to Collins.
Really? You would think it would be the other way around, right? You would think that they felt sold out, yeah?
You would. Like, some people did. Like, McKelvey was one of the IRA members in Belfast who was executed, one of the 77 executions.
Yeah.
But, like, people like Roger McCorley, really, really hardcore IRA members in the North, they all kind of believed Collins would, you know, help them out. You know, they believed sort of second Tet Offensive was going to happen in the North. Mm.
Let me ask you two difficult questions, Usher. I'm going to put you on the spot. If you were fucking one of those guys, which side would you have went with?
Jesus, that's a good question. Would I, in this scenario, would I know what I know now?
No.
Or would I be around the guy? I would have felt sold out, to be honest. Yeah. If I was in the
would
North.
Would you?
If you were in the North, but if you were one of the guys in Dublin fighting side by side with Collins, and he comes back and he goes, here's what's going to happen, would you be pro-treaty, anti-treaty, and would you be enough of one or the other to fight?
That's a really good question.
It's hard, right?
Very hard. I don't know. It really depends where I was and who I knew. I mean, if I knew Collins personally, and, you know, if I had some inside information that he wasn't going to screw us over, I'd be like, all right, I'll play along for now. And it's funny, a lot of people who became anti-treaty IRA people did play along for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Like Tom Barry came up and talked with Collins for quite a bit. I was trying to stave off civil war as long as he could. But he just couldn't. I think it's impossible because you can't broadcast everybody, don't worry, lads, we're going into the north to invade. Mm-hmm. It's all right.
There's a lot of countries have a civil war early on. It's like a disease, man. It's best to have it when you're young and get it over with, right? It's an interesting thing. And then the second question is, what would have happened if Collins hadn't died? Do you think he would have did a military invasion into the north? Because at that point, the British Army's coming in droves, right? And you have a freaking another set-piece battle with one of the most trained and professional armies in the world. And whatever about intelligence and hit and run and all that kind of thing, but if you want to do a set-piece battle with the British Army who just got out of World War One, man, that's a lot of killing going on right there.
It's funny, like, I mean, up until the point where when the truce was ending, Winston Churchill wanted to use mustard gas and biological warfare on the Irish.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it? So, like, I mean, I think personally, I think it really depends. I think if Collins had survived, I think we would have probably, I think it probably would have been an invasion of the North. I don't know what the outcome would have been, but my opinion is if the British had killed him post-truce rather than the Irish, there would have been wholesale murder. The people like Daly and Neligan, all their fury wouldn't have been directed at their fellow Irishmen, it would be directed at the British.
Purely speculation, right? We'll never know. But it's an interesting topic to talk about. How long did it take to kind of settle this stuff out?
Jeez, honestly, truth be told, I don't think it ever did settle out. I think it rumbled along like everything does in Ireland.
Yeah. There's probably families to this day that love them or hate them, you know? Irish can hold a grudge like nobody you've ever seen.
Yeah, like my family split during the Civil War. One side were very, very Republican. The other side were also Republican, but they were very loyal to Collins. On my granny's side, her uncle was Collins' bodyguard in Cross McGlen in Armagh.
Yeah, yeah. I bet that family had a picture of Collins, a picture of John F. Kennedy, and a picture of the Pope on the wall.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other people were very much anti-treaty, but, you know, there'd still be some degree of animosity there, you know?
Mm-hmm. At the same time, it
does mean that, at the very least, some people hold principles, you know? I mean, even if the grudge means they hold some sort of principle, you know? Like, people saying, we're all the same, it's, you know...
Yeah. At some point, you got to pick a side. You got to pick a team. Yeah. The very famous photograph of Collins, which I'll put up on the YouTube video, of him walking with the Webley and the drop leg holster with a little kid behind him. Yeah, you told me before, I can't remember. What's the context of that photo?
Oh, jeez, I can't remember now.
I think it wasn't the treaty signing, but it was obviously after the treaty because he's in full uniform. He has he looks like British Army, man. They took the British Army uniforms and everything, I think. But he's got the riding breeches on. He's got the drop leg holster. And it's a badass picture for some reason, right? I thought maybe when somebody told me the context of that before. And somebody can put it in the comments down below on the YouTube video. But and there's a little kid behind him looking at him. And it wasn't me before somebody says it. I'm not that old.
Yeah.
My favorite photo of him is in the first Dáil, where you just see him there, like everyone's there for the very first meeting of the Irish Parliament.
Yeah.
And you just see his arms crossed, and the look on his face tells you this guy isn't about politics. This guy.
It's a whole new battle, man, whole new battlefield. Dirtier. It's dirtier than the actual war, right? Oisin, that was great, man. Thank you so much. It's very, very interesting piece of Irish history. A lot of people just don't know. I learned a lot. Irish history goes back so far. I remember learning it in high school and just being bored to tears. If Dad had told me there was assassinations and hit squads, I would have paid more attention. But it's, you know, those old European countries, man, that it goes back freaking so far. And the Irish War of Independence and the Irish Civil War, it's part of growing up, man. And there were people involved that really, really did put their life on the line and build the country to what it is today. So I really appreciate you coming on. It's always interesting. People, when are you coming back to the States?
Actually, I'm flying back in a few months, actually. I'm going over to a conference there.
Where?
I'm going to San Diego, but I'm flying back to North Carolina.
And you are? A bit of time. Hell yeah, let's go shoot together, man. Let's go do a bit of long range stuff. Yeah, we'll hit Coleman's Creek and we'll do a little bit. I'm heading out to Utah in October, November to train with the Marine Corps, and then I've got class in Virginia in December, which is sold out. And I'm looking to do more stuff. I'm looking to do more long range stuff next year, like maybe kind of expand it a little bit. But people can always do Zoom calls. I did two Zoom calls yesterday with guys. And people love it, man, because you can sit down. It's individual training for you on what you need. Kirsten does Zoom calls too, but it's a great way to train from the comfort of your own home. So check that out. Oisin, thank you so much, brother. And until next time, I want to do this once a month if you can swing it. There's like 50 people outside your waiting room now going, why is this guy not going? All right. Thanks, brother.
All right.
Okay.
See you next.
Bye.